Welcome here. This is a class on communicating clearly. Can you finish the quote? You've said it several times now. Grant me the talent of being exact in my... Yeah, you just said that in the prayer there that Brother Steve has been having us recite. Grant me the talent of being exact in my explanations. This class hopefully will be a means to that end. I hope so. I'd like to just amble my way into this a little bit more slowly, so if you would indulge this amble here. Perhaps now you're beginning to feel like, it's a Thursday or something, and you're getting pretty full, and the cup got full and running over, and maybe that would be a good song to sing. I would like to recommend that you think of these times here at WFTI as programming your mindset. Mm-hmm. I found that when I was teaching, having been here many, many times, it wasn't that I thought on the spur of the moment, I remember at WFTI, blah, 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 blah. No, it wasn't that. It was more that we kind of teach what's already in there, somewhat subconsciously. So don't stress it, in other words, is what I'm trying to tell you. Mm-hmm. Just absorb it. Mm-hmm. And don't feel you have to have it all written down unless that helps you absorb it. But the amount of time that I actually have gone back to notes that I've taken at WFTI have been very few, with the exception of referencing the book, the quote that I want to look up and meditate on more, meditate, whatever. You get the idea, okay? It's all part of this absorption thing and programming a mindset. So with that, let's move along into more directly about communicating clearly. The context is, yes? Is there any more handouts? I should ask. How many would appreciate a handout? Don't have one yet. Oh, good. Well, wonderful. No hands in the air? There's one. Okay. You notice the handout does have blanks. First letter is the clue letter for that word. The context, obviously, is school, the field, the uses of communications are as wide as the world. So we are going to try to laser focus into the exchange between teacher and student, because that is, after all, what we're about, is it not? That exchange. Now, who or what is the final judge of this matter of communicating clearly? Is it you that's the final judge? Is it the school board that's the final judge? Is it the patron that's the final judge? S-word, what is it? The students are the final judge. And again, broadening out just a little bit here, we're here to, yes, as instructors, we're very concerned about programming your mindset, equipping you, giving you tools in your toolbox where you can go out back to your students, back to your classrooms, and be an effective teacher. But yet, this whole institute is not about you. How many students are you going to have, Jaden? This next year?
13.
13?
Somewhere between 8 and 9 is what we're
doing.
8? 4. 10, 4, 7, 10, 7.
You get the idea? Mm-hmm. It's them. We're not operating school for you. If you want to be in private practice, go start a pizza shop. Go start a cabinet shop. Go start a floral shop. All right? Right? It's about our students.
That's right.
Okay, and that's why we're so interested in communicating clearly. Because if the things that we're trying to communicate only make sense to us, or only make sense to the visiting patron or the school board member, by the way, some of the best teaching I've ever done is when a patron or a school board member sitting in the back. See what happened? My focus is messed up. All right. It's the student. It's student mastery that counts. Harry Wong says, if the students have failed the lesson, anybody want to guess what goes in there? If the students have failed the lesson, finish it, please, anybody. We have failed the student. You got it. You got it. A story is told of a man sweeping the floor at NASA. He's sweeping the floor there with a push broom, I imagine it. Somebody asks him, what are you doing? He says, I'm sending a man to the moon. I like that. I like that a whole lot. If I were the director of NASA, which will never happen, but if I were, I would think he's a great man to have on the team, right? Mm-hmm. Get that vision. Get that. I just really appreciate that. Our vision is that we're sending a man to the moon. We're dealing with students, right? We want to have the students achieve and excel and even go launch and go beyond what we have gone. All right, let's go to helps for explaining clearly. This is full disclosure here. It is a completely how-to oriented topic here. Right? It's not going to be so esoteric as to just give you some ideas about communication that are intellectual only. This is work boot in nature. All right, so there we go. Let's go to help number one. Think like a child. Think like a child. Try to think things through from their perspective. Good salesmen are not unlike good teachers, and that a good salesman is always thinking about the person who he is trying to get to purchase his product, right? And he's trying to think about their anxieties and their resistance and what they might be thinking. All right, so think like a child. Imagine yourself in their position. And in that position, you can explain more things more clearly. In shepherding terms, this is called building the feed box slow enough for the lambs. Okay, the nicest feed box in the county. But if the lambs can't reach it, what have we done? Well, we built ourselves a feed box, not one for the lambs. See, I had to think about a time that I was visiting an Amish school. It was a one-room Amish school with two teachers, but there was a big, husky, single fella teaching first grade. And I was just really amazed. He had a line of children. It was at one of these plastic folding tables, and he had at least seven children, on the short ends and on the long side. But he was not standing up in front of that table pacing back and forth. No, he was down like this on his knees. Both knees, and he had his hands like this on the table and his chin on his hands, and he was talking to the students like that. Right? Do you think he might have been an effective teacher? Mm-hmm. Thumbs up. Yes. It was really, really awesome to watch him interact. Right? Now, yes, there were some times he got up, but it was to put stuff up on the board. It was when he had to be on his feet that he was being on his feet, but the rest of the time he was on his knees. Right? And his physique, I think, made it that he almost had to be. Otherwise, he'd have been towering over them as some sort of big ogre of sorts. Right? But there was a man who was thinking about how he's coming across. He was thinking about the students. He was thinking about their anxieties. And he was in their mind. And I know he was an effective teacher. I know he was. Build your feed box slow enough for the lambs. And there's so many ways this can be done. Just think about it. Think about it. I have, not sure exactly how to describe what I'm thinking next, but I've seen teachers, it's persona, that's what it is if you were in that class. A teacher's persona when they're with a first and a second and a third grade is not what it is when they're in staff meeting or when they're talking with me, all right? And I think that extends beyond first, second, and third grade. It extends into fourth and fifth and sixth, and maybe even into high school, maybe so. All right, let's go to the second one. I have on the back side of your handout the seven laws of teaching, which I see I don't have on the back side of my handout. Thank you, Ryan. I thought I had it somewhere here. Let me just flip around a little bit more. Yeah, there it is. Thank you. These seven laws are so good that in 1888, I believe it was, John Milton Gregory published the book, The Seven Laws of Teaching. And they just stand. They just endure. And you can't really improve on them. You can't really take any away. I'd like to suggest that there's four of these laws that relate very directly to this idea of communicating clearly. Right? And I'd suggest that they're the first four. Let's look at Law 1. In order for clear explanations and communications, the teacher must be the one who knows the lesson or truth to be taught. Okay? Very foundational. But yet we do need to remind ourselves of it, especially if there was volleyball last night. Right? If you're going to be an effective teacher, you better know what you're going to be teaching. And I really like that idea. I never had a template that Steve was talking about. But yet I kind of did. It just wasn't a physical one. Right? But every lesson we need to know what we're going to teach. Otherwise, how are they going to know? How are we even going to know once we've taught it? If you don't know, you can't help to explain clearly. Likely all of us at times who have taught before have realized that, you know, we just didn't study this enough. And it's kind of unhandy because when you're in front of the orchestra at that point, I mean, you're supposed to be directing, right? And what can you do except bluff? Right? And that can kind of sort of work, right? I mean, if the students end up succeeding in that lesson, if they didn't fail their lesson, it wasn't because of us that they succeeded. It was in spite of us. That's what. Okay? So, yeah, you can sneak by a few times. You can sneak in a text or two when you're driving, but it's dangerous business, folks. It's really dangerous business, right? So your teacher must know, be in the know, right? I like to think of a teacher when it comes to their lessons and when it comes to the natural world as being some sort of insect with two antennas on the top that have a 360-degree gimbal sort of eyeball, all right? And it's just turning and it's looking at everything, front, back, up, and down. All right, because they're in that quest to know. They want to observe. They want to be able to just make sense of things, right, in the real world so that they can help their students make sense of things, right? But foundational to communicating clearly is law one, knowing the lesson, the truth, or the art to be taught. I remember I was on a tour speaking of dams this morning. I was at Grand Coulee Dam. I was very excited. I was taking my dad there, and it was the first time he had come out to the Pacific Northwest to visit us. So, you know, I wanted to show him a good time, have him a good time, and so on. We went there, and they had this high school kid. In fact, it was two of them. And I use the word kid very often, but I used this time with pleasure. They had two high school girls in ponytail and braces that were the tour guides for the Grand Coulee Dam. Sorry, and they didn't know a thing. Hardly. I could have done a better job than they did, right? And it's not because I don't have a ponytail. I overheard as we walked between, observation stations, the lead girl says to the other kid, "Well, now I got to figure out what to tell them at the next station." This is a really cool job because you get to tell them anything, they'll believe it. I don't know what the Christian response is to that, but I don't know, pound head against brick wall.
Lovingly, right.
Right. Redemptively. Let's go to law two. We're going to just touch briefly on this one. The learner is the one who attends with interest to the lesson. This relates to our subject at hand, that the student's interest will wane if we aren't explaining clearly, all right? So part of clear communication is securing the student's attention and keeping the student's attention, right? We must know the truth, right? And the student is the one to whom the lesson is directed, but it's our job then to hold the student's attention, right? You've heard the saying that you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink, right? And there's a measure of truth in that. But that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about chapter 2 of that quote, which is what? You can put salt in his oats, right? Now, you can't force a horse to drink, but you can put salt in his feed that'll make him thirsty, all right? So that's our part. Even though this law is directed towards a learner, the teacher has a job in keeping salt in the feed. Keeping it interesting, right? And how can we make it interesting? Well, one method is to ask lots of questions, right? Keep them engaged, right? There's lots of things that we could expand almost indefinitely. Use review, get them to help. Use the chalkboard. And let's just put a simple sentence up here.
Care for that marker. One of the things I don't like about, there we go, markers is half worn out ones. Okay, so we're going to diagram this sentence. Bill kicked the cat. And that's a popular one with me because there's action in there. Okay, I can see that happening. I'm especially thinking of the cat. Okay, so class, call it out. What's the subject?
Bill.
Bill, the predicate.
Kick.
All right, and what's the direct object?
Cat.
All right. Does anybody see a mistake that I put on the board? Okay. See, I just used another one. Maybe ask them, I need your help here. Obviously, if it's a direct object, we need a straight line. There's all sorts of things you can do by intention when you're using the board to keep your class with you, keep them engaged. And it doesn't have to be fancy schmancy.
All it has to be is just something that keeps them with you, and you have
that's
them, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right. So when you're doing things on the board, you know, really, there were at least three things there that I had going, or that you had going. It's not about me, it's about you, right? The one is you had that visual.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The other is, what was it now? It just popped into my mind. I had you responding.
Yep.
Okay. And the other is I did something wrong. It was sort of like boom between the eyes, right? Something's
mm-hmm.
going on here that's not right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And then I asked you to correct it. Mm-hmm. Multi levels of student involvement are what we're trying to engage in.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We're talking about the student law too. What does it say? The student is the one who attends with interest to the lesson. Be sure that you're interesting. If you're interesting, you'll be communicating effectively. That's the idea. All right, law three. The language used as a medium between the teacher and learner must be common to both. Now, we could illustrate this lesson very easily and say if you're teaching English students, you can't use French, right? But it goes much different, much deeper than that. For instance, I had a student one time that asked me, why are you grading art? It was my first year teaching in this community, and they didn't grade art. Well, I was used to grading art, so of course I did what I was used to. He said, why are you grading art? Takes the fun out of it. And I said, oh, well, you know, yeah, I get that, but we do want an incentive. And he got quiet, and I thought, well, I'll put that one to bed. It wasn't but a few minutes later I heard him asking one of his fellow students, what question? What does incentive mean? Right? I hadn't communicated at all. The language wasn't common to both. It was true that I was using English, but I wasn't using English in a way that he had learned how to use English yet, you see. So teachers should use words that will raise the clearest images in the minds of their pupils. Right? So, would it the clearest word, you tell me, which word would be the best word to use in your classroom? You're going to talk about a riot or a brouhaha? Uh-huh. Yeah. It's fun to say brouhaha. That's one of my favorite words. Almost as good as titicaca, Lake Titicaca.
Yeah.
But as fun as it is, and as cool as it is, it's not about me having fun, right? Okay. Are we going to talk about appendages or fingers and toes? Well, okay, it maybe depends on the lesson, right? If we're in science class and we're having a lesson on human anatomy and physiology, well, then we might be using appendages because it is true. As was told us before in this conference, that every field of knowledge has its lingo,
yeah.
Right? And so oftentimes it's just learning that vocabulary. Like I did use subject and I did use predicate, and we do see how they coincide with a noun and verb. And we talk about, well, predicate nouns, we don't have one of those here. And then later they change to predicate nominatives and so on. We have to understand that language to be able to understand what's going on. But as Steve said in his class the other day, a brain surgeon can take off the skull and peer into the brain and go, well, right there, that's the all of us would go, that's the, and we just, we're done. We it's a brain, yes, but what part of the brain and what does it do? We don't see understanding the subject. There is language that goes along to support that knowledge, right? But let's be sure that we're guiding them that vocabulary and explain it as we go along, right? I was going to read from a book called Plain Speaking by David Berceau. That is, by the way, a very good resource on this very subject, plain speaking, right? Plain speaking. And he gives the illustration in there of a magazine, National Review, which is rather elite and esoteric magazine, has a subscription of about 150,000, which is not very much for one that actually does have national distribution. Its readership are more the elite people of society, the college professors and so on. But its language is lofty, quite lofty. And you probably have never heard of the National Review, many of us didn't. But how many ever heard of Reader's Digest? See? It has a subscription rate of millions, like 70 million or something like that. But its language, part of its guidelines for the level of language and vocabulary, the average is going to be on what grade? Any guesses? Well, I believe it's fourth.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now you can go up to a 10th grade word before you as a writer will get that word kicked out. Okay, but that's pretty fascinating, isn't it?
Oh.
So overall, people prefer the simple language than to highly polished literary diction. Okay, you kind of get the idea. Even that sounded just a bit stilted for our circles. Let's go to number four. The truth to be taught must be learned through truth already known. Again, our focus here is on communicating clearly. I think this law is no more clearly illustrated than this situation. That is when the first men walked on the moon. They played in the dust, knelt down and played in the dust as two little boys do on the playground out here. And the one in his gloved hands made a scoop of dust. And he says, this is like, I don't know what all he was doing, probably pouring it back and forth. He said, it's like baby powder. And the other one said, well, I was going to say Portland cement. Now, if you know anything about either one of those, or both, now you understand moon dust.
Yeah.
Right? But notice how in this otherworldly situation, they went back to the known world to be able to describe the new. That's our job as a teacher. If we're going to effectively communicate, we have to start where students are to be able to take them where we want them to be. Very, very basic truth. And that's why starting their lesson on direct objects, it's just so lovely to say, now folks, we know already that this is the noun and this is the verb and this is the subject and this becomes a predicate. Now we're going to add the direct, you see what we're saying?
Mm-hmm.
The old leads into the new.
That's
and
right.
To communicate clearly, almost every single lesson that you teach, especially in the skills-based subject, you can start with review and almost unknowingly flop into the new lesson. Okay? And the students will come along with you, just like little ducklings follow the name of the mother. If you take this approach in your classroom, that's the way it works. If you're going to say, now we're going to learn how to divide fractions, well, it's a great place. The place to start that lesson is not with the division of fractions. It's with the what of fractions? M word? Multiplication of fractions. Right? So go ahead and go do some multiplication of fractions and say, now folks, all you need to do for this lesson today is you need to, and here we go with some words that need to be understood, right? We use the reciprocal of the divisor. What does reciprocal mean? Does your dad have a reciprocating saw? On a reciprocating saw, does the blade go back and forth or does it go round and round? See what we're talking about? Known world, perhaps, if your boy... is the son of a carpenter, right? If they never heard of the word reciprocating before, you can ask them, well, does your mom have a bread knife? My mom had a bread knife that had two reciprocating blades that went like this, back and forth. We're learning about reciprocal, see? Now we're back to where we had been a few miles ago. But what are we talking about? We're talking about how the truth must be taught through truth already known. Try to link the learning together. Use figures of speech. Use figures of speech. Use objects, metaphor. For instance, I had a course that I taught over and over when I taught there at the Russian school. Many of them went into nursing. So we sort of did like pre-med biology. We focused on human anatomy and physiology and infectious disease and that type of stuff. Now that all sort of culminated in butchering a hog. And I would sort of try to say, now, how much do you all weigh? Okay, so we get an average of about 120 pounds. And then I'd go find a hog that weighed about 120 pounds because it is unflatteringly, there's a lot of similarities in the anatomy and physiology of a hog. And so much so that, in fact, that, you know, like heart valves and so forth can be taken out of hogs and put in people and it works. So then we not really butcher, more of a dissecting, right? And one day, as we were doing our hog dissection, I mean, it takes all day, but that's okay. They don't seem to care. We get it all laid out in a big, long row, many multiple tables, right? All the different organs and stuff. I was right into the heart of things, literally. And one of the students says, hey, there's a Walmart bag. And I was kind of annoyed, really, because, you know, there I was making myself all bloody and messy, and they're looking at Walmart bags blowing across the parking lot. And a bunch of those students picked up, they start talking about Walmart bags too. And then it was really, I said, folks, you know, stay with me here, right? This is really interesting. Just stay with me. Well, they said, we are. They said, you're the one that said that. I said, what? Well, you said that the heart is in a Walmart bag. And I remembered, yes, when we studied the heart, we were talking about, what do you call the thing, the pleurisy? Is that right? No, that's the disease when this sac gets inflamed. Your heart is in a sac.
Yeah.
Okay? And the reason it's in a sac is because it's doing a lot of jerking around. To reduce the abrasion, God put it in a slippery membrane. Right? And I said, it's just kind of like, when I was teaching, I forgot I said this. It's kind of like it's in a Walmart bag. Right?
Aww.
See, and they said, there's the Walmart bag.
Well, there it is.
We're using metaphor. They could understand that. And they were ahead of me on this, as I was actually in the chest of that hog. Let's go to moving on. I guess we're going to leave the seven laws right now to help us communicate clearly. Know the minimums for mastery in each lesson. And I unashamedly borrow from Bruce Wilkinson's book, The Seven Laws of the Learner, which you might want to get that book sometime. The Seven Laws of the Learner by Bruce Wilkinson. It has a subtitle of How to Teach Almost Anything to Practically Everyone. I like that title. But the idea here of minimums for mastery is every day, every lesson, narrow it down to answer this question. What are the key concepts, or what is the key concept of this lesson? I'm ashamed to say that I taught many years before Bruce Wilkinson finally helped me out. Okay, this is so clarifying when you go to study. Is kind of like, well, what's this lesson driving at? Okay, what's the point? Identify that point. And so many of the teacher's helps and even the student material, it'll have those there for you. Right? But be sure that you know those minimums for mastery. We simply can't teach everything in a day or everything the student will need to know about a particular field of knowledge or even about a particular subject. But what are we trying to teach in this lesson? And let's get that very clearly in front of us so that we can get it inside of us so that it can flow out clearly. Right? Teach it, explain it, show it, demonstrate it, instruct it, portray, indoctrinate, lecture, discuss, educate, train, drill those concepts. And then you have it. Right? I would recommend that you read that whole book. If you don't want to read it, why, it is available recorded. Bruce Wilkinson does the recording, and I like Bruce. He's a fun guy to be with. Help number seven, don't be afraid to repeat yourself. Mm-hmm. Don't be afraid to repeat yourself for two reasons. You see, now I'm stuck on it, right? Well, most of our learning at elementary school is very incremental, right? And it's that way for a purpose. It's for student mastery, of course. We aren't going to learn the stuff any other way. We have to be told it multiple times, mm-hmm. Okay? And the scripture itself says, Isaiah 28:10, precept upon you say it, and then again it says it again, just as if we didn't hear it, precept upon precept, line upon,
line
upon,
line.
Here a,
little.
And there a,
little.
All right? That's the way it works. I wonder sometimes if we could get, say your school goes through the 10th grade, or whether it goes through the 12th, or whether it goes through the 8th, it doesn't really matter. Suppose that we only had to teach a subject, a particular concept, a minimum for mastery. Suppose we only had to teach it once. How long would the students need to go to school?
Not very long.
Not very long. Suppose you only had to teach them once and practice it once. It's a as an apple. Well, we could have them through, I think, 10 years in one.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So don't be afraid to repeat yourself. Right? And the other reason that we need to repeat ourselves is because information leaks out of us, you know, way too fast to retain it all. We really are like egg baskets or like sieves. I remember speaking to one man, asking him when I was working with him Monday morning. I said, so what did your preacher preach about yesterday? He was a church-going man, same as I. He said, I don't remember. I said, well, think a little bit. I'd just kind of like to know. And he said, look, he said, I'm an egg basket. He said, I know I've been washed, but he said, I don't remember. Right? Well, maybe he should have tried to retain a little bit more, but that doesn't mean that his going to church was completely futile. Point simply being that we tend to lose our marbles as we go through life. They slip out through our egg basket, right? So repetition, then, is a vital part of explaining and communicating clearly, right? If you're one of those carpenters, those of you who have not been teachers, you're moving, let's say, out of a pole barn crew that likes to be able to sink a 16-penny nail in with one crack after you have it set, you're going to have to slow down. It goes in by small taps.
That's right.
It's incremental.
That's right.
Okay? And humans themselves don't change quickly at all. And that's really what learning is. It's changing behaviors.
That's right.
Right? Now we can get a direct object placed on our diagram. Now we can divide by fractions. It's really a behavior that we're trying to adjust, that we're trying to teach. And I tell you, you think you change slow and it's hard work. Well, you do, and I do, but the other guys are usually slower and harder to change. Right? So just don't be afraid to repeat yourself. And by all means, develop the chalkboard habit or dry erase board habit. There's so much to be said for that. And just on a very practical note, I'm going to work at the chalkboard here. Please, class, be watching as I draw here on the class. The very important part of your lesson today. So that's it, folks. You got it. If you can see this here, you've gotten your lesson today. Well, the point is, draw off to the side, okay? Yeah, learn how to draw away from yourself, and then don't turn around, stand in front of it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Otherwise, it was for you and not for the student. Mm-hmm. Okay. Help number 9. What time does this class close? We have 15 minutes. I think maybe this one, finally, we're going to be able to have some discussion. I was hoping to get to a point where we come to the end of what I had, so think about that. Beware and choose between the process and the concept method of teaching. Okay. I think this understanding this is sort of a deep dive into how we actually go to teach a skill subject. Okay, so just come along with me on this. But how did your mother teach you how to tie your shoe? Did she teach you by process, or did she teach you by concept?
Mm-hmm.
Process. And why do you say process, Aaron? Give me some indicators, or anybody. How do we know Aaron's right?
Well, I mean, it's hard to explain. I mean, the theory behind it that I know of, I don't know, you just do it.
Yeah. So it sounded like this when Aaron was learning how to tie. No, Aaron, make a rabbit ear.
Mm-hmm.
All right? Now pinch it here.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Now take the string around this. No, the other way.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's all process-based
mm-hmm.
talk.
Mm-hmm.
If it were conceptual-based talk, how would it sound? Well, now what you need, Aaron, is you need something that has the ability to take varying lengths of string, you know, and make something that can be untied very easily.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we don't... I think that we have sort of developed the idea that if we're not teaching concept, we're not teaching in school. And I think especially for elementary school grades 1 through 8, even a little bit beyond that, if we would emphasize teaching process just a little bit more, it would be more clear. You see, it's because after doing that process 100 and 200 and 300 times, how many of us have not sat there and marveled at the ingenuity of the concept of the knot that you use on your shoe?
Mm-hmm.
All right? You see what happens? But that's not the starting point.
That's right.
All right? Shall we put this into something that's... Let's go to 7th grade. I just have a little demonstration here. I don't have this out of my head anymore. It's been a long time since I taught
geometry. But here's a formula for the surface area of a cylinder. 2 pi r squared plus 2 pi r h. That's sort of a little off the tongue.
Right? That is the formula to find the surface area of a cylinder. Here's a cylinder, right? Surface area meaning the two bases and the sides. Okay? So I'm going to first of all teach this conceptually. And just hang on. Right, and then I'm going to try to teach it by process. Okay, so if this is the minimum for mastery is to get students proficient in using this formula to find the surface area of a cylinder. All right, so class, here you see this formula has 2 sections, right? Well, so does this can. It has 2 bases. It has 2, what shape is this?
Circles,
all right. So do you remember what is the formula for finding the perimeter of a circle? P equals
pi d.
All right. Or pi d. Another way to say that would be P equals 2
pi r, right?
Because twice the radius is the diameter.
Okay, so what this is really a cool formula. I'm teaching conceptually here. It's really a cool formula because what this package of numbers does is it really gets this circle and it takes it and it splits it into ever increasingly smaller slices, and it arranges them in a rectangle. And so we have these slices here, fat end narrowing, fat end narrowing, fat end narrowing. Okay, you see what's happening? That's what this formula does. It kind of like gets, you know, and lays it out into a rectangle. And so, maybe I better stay close to my notes here. This is getting pretty technical, right? But this is the concept, folks, behind this formula. Okay? So this side, see, how long would this thing be in relation to the perimeter of the circle? The length of this rectangle would be what part of it? Can you help me out?
Half.
Half, right. Because half of the fat ends are up and half are down. All right. So what becomes the length and what becomes the width? Well, the width is R,
mm-hmm.
right? And so the rest of it, two. Two has to do with the two ends.
Right. Yeah,
that's right.
So pi times radius is half, see, the perimeter.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Mm-hmm. Are you, is anybody still with me? A little tiny bit. Okay?
I'm not really.
That's why I wanted a can that was still full, because it dries so well. Concept is hard to teach.
Yeah.
I actually think I did get it.
Yeah.
Okay, so I did. Michael, you can have this can of olives.
Okay. And then, of course, this relates to the bases, right? The one side, you know, it splits
the. Yeah. And now we have a rectangle, right? Okay. Yeah. All right. That was teaching conceptually. Now let's go to teaching by process. All right.
So in a lesson like this, it's going to give a problem that says number 6. You have a cylinder that the radius equals 6 inches and the height equals 10 inches.
All right, so class, what you do today is you're getting the radius, and yes, you might be waving this can around in the air. You get the radius, and
you plug that in right here.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and then you get the height, and you plug that in right here. Oh, and here you need the 6 again because it's a radius, and then you do the math, and then you're done. Does that sound like a teacher? See, I think we've gotten all the notion that unless it's complex, unless we're teaching concept, in other words, we aren't quite worth our salt.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how many students at the end of the day, let's suppose we have a classroom of 15 seventh grade students, how many of them at the end of the day are going to be with you?
I mean, I couldn't even keep a class of intelligent folks like you with me when I went into concept. Okay? Well, if you're teaching process, you bring many, many more people along with you. And I think it's just fine in the lower elementary grades, and the elementary grades especially, to be emphasizing process and be satisfied if they have process. I want students to be able to walk out of my classroom and at least be able to do something,
mm-hmm.
right? Other than go and the breaker tripped.
Right? Yeah.
Choose between the two. Let me see. Do I have anything else I wanted to say that about that? I don't think so. Let's just open it up. I'm done. Did you get all the words in your little paper? Go.
All right.
Go ahead, Gil.
So do you ever explain formulas?
Yes.
Like high school especially?
Yes. And even in seventh grade, you know, it's kind of interesting. Once you start explaining some of the basic ones, many of them are going to come up with it themselves. And then you can say, all right, we're done with math class. But if there's anybody that wants to explain the formula from yesterday, you can come up and do that now.
Mm-hmm. Do you find that they remember how to do something, like say the surface area of a cylinder, better if they know like the general concept, if we have a rectangle around the side, and
we right.
have the surface area of the circle,
yeah.
versus just memorizing a formula?
Well, I personally do that. But again, it comes back to which is going to serve the student better. Again, it depends a little bit on the age. We're not talking about teaching college level. Mm-hmm. We're talking about teaching the elementary grades and slightly beyond. Yes.
Well, what I found really effective for my kind of non-math operation is to teach the process like this, maybe a wee bit of concept, and then later on, after they've truly mastered it, and you're not going to confuse the one who gets really easily confused.
Right.
Then you go ahead and take the time and teach them the concept,
right.
and they're like, oh, yeah, check that out. That works.
Yeah. You know? Mm-hmm. See, I had a class of 6th, 7th graders one time. We actually were working through the unit of this kind of stuff right here, and I was giving them opportunity to explain it. Right, there was really only 2 out of the 4 that took interest in it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and the 2 that were at the bottom end of the class, it was kind of like 2 that were at the bottom, as far as they were just able to keep their nose above water.
Mm-hmm.
Like they didn't even listen to the explanations that the other students gave of how they worked.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a rather complex one similar to this that one of my 7th grade boys got out front. He just, boom, he just laid it out.
Yeah.
See, I don't know if you could tell or not, but I had a lot of rust on me trying to teach this stuff.
Yeah.
If we had all gone through a unit, on geometry and gotten to this in 7th grade, mm-hmm. we would have had a lot of rust off of our plowshares. We'd have been nice and shiny and smooth, right? And plow would have went a whole lot easier. But this 7th grade boy, he jumped up and he explained that, the whole thing, in less time than I explained just the first half.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and I was like, John, how did you do that? He said, I did my lesson yesterday. I said, yes, but the lesson yesterday didn't explain it. Well, he said, after you do it about 5 or 6 times, he said, you start beginning to think. Not all students are going to start beginning to think how it works. Should we force them into that mold? Or should we just say, look, we want them to be able to plug in the data and do the calculation? What is the minimum for mastery? See?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Shifting gears a little bit. So you talked about speaking so we can all understand the lingo we're using. So,
right.
So what about pushing them? How do you balance that with pushing them to learn more words? So I remember Jeff Jarman preaching and getting up and saying, I have a predilection for excessively obtuse verbosity. And I'll never forget that. I heard that on a CD and I memorized it.
One more time, please.
Yeah.
A predilection for excessively verbose.
Obtuse verbosity. There you go. So how do we get them interested in that and going to another level instead of just dumbing everything down? And I think that's a problem, if I may, when that got older. I think it's a little bit of a problem in church. If we're not careful, we dumb things down so far that there's nothing lofty left anymore.
It becomes a Reader's Digest type of experience.
So where's the balance? I agree with what you were teaching. Can you help us a little bit?
Well, that reminded me. One time I was discussing something about how to create a partial vacuum, and it just occurred to me when I was talking about it that a syringe, right, a common syringe, most of us have, especially those of us who grew up on the farm, will put their thumb over the end where the needle goes on and pull back on the plunger of the syringe, right, and you feel that pressure and you can leave it fly and so on. And I was talking about that. And the reason I brought that up is because there was this bulky farm girl there in 8th grade that she was very non-scientific, or she was basically illiterate scientifically. So I was trying to connect with her, right? And it wasn't connecting. I was like, come on, she knows all about syringes. I knew she gives kept shots, right? Because I listened to her break. And we were just weren't connecting about this thing of the syringe. And I finally said, come on, you haven't messed around with a syringe. She said, I don't know what a syringe is. And so I thought you give cow shots. Oh, you mean a shot? Okay, sure, yeah, a shot. All right, but that day, what happened? She learned what a syringe was.
That's right.
See, I think that a lot of this happens passively. And to force it actively beyond what we're already teaching about subjects and predicates and nominative absolutes and the lingo that goes along with it, I kind of think that maybe I'm suggesting a bit of a border. I mean, kind of like... Mm-hmm. Except fun words. Please allow me to use brouhaha. But I really don't go for these page day calendars that have sesquipedalian and things like that. You know what sesquipedalian means? A lover of long words. I think so. Any other thought on his question? I shouldn't have answered it.
I mean, I think that there is a place to excite you, but if you're careful when you do introduce words that you think might be new or hard, to give the synonyms at the same time.
Good one.
Just be honest. Say this is a cool word and I like it and it means such and such.
Right.
And then they know what it means.
Right.
Students very much, if they come to a word that they don't know, and you really get this when you're teaching them another language, when they come to a word they don't know, their mind stops at that word, a lot of students, and can't go forward. Like, it's like, what does that word mean? And they miss the rest of your explanation. And so when you use a big word they don't understand, there's going to be a large part of your class, and that's the part of the class that you don't want to lose, that sit there looking straight at you, in another world trying to process this word. And so make sure they know what you're saying, or you've wasted your time talking.
Yeah. The point there is that a student's mind stops. That communication, the thinking process, is it's hijacked when they hit language that they don't understand anymore. Right? And so that's why I think if we're going to make an error here, let's err on allowing them to increase their on the side of the ditch, letting them increase their vocabulary passively rather than swamping them out with all these mega-boo-hoo cylinder words, whatever syllable, you know. That's not going to work either.
That's right.
I like how you introduce a lot of new words today. And I think we all understand what they are based on the context.
Such as?
Esoteric.
You know what esoteric means? Out there somewhere. Yeah. I think so. Now, if you look it up in the dictionary, it's not going to say out there somewhere. Intellectual, right? Kind of on the fringes of practicality.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Ooh, he's being recorded.
That's probably all false. Okay, but yeah, just I think in the normal whatever, in the normal go of things, vocabulary is going to move forward. But that doesn't answer your question about these numbskull conversations we have at places like, I won't say where. I know what you're saying. That was the bell. Thank you. And by all means, communicate clearly.
One good way to really get your students onto new words is to get them reading. Get them to read, because there's something about reading books that just makes you, I don't know, learn new.
John, I actually heard you use the word esoteric when you were having this meeting in the North Carolina. And I didn't know what it basically means. It's a higher level. An esoteric thought is one that would be more to do with the mental side, your physical, and more abstract now.
I learned that every joke should want to be read before. So
Steve's commentary on your
physical thought was more esoteric. Well, John was talking about it.
In theory, yes. This was very practical. This was, and his was more to do like your mind was engaged the whole time. Not necessarily thinking, oh, that's what I'll teach so-and-so on Monday.